Okay. Who's the Monday?
I stuck it there. Could I have a thing?
Yeah.
Lily, what time do you have to be here?
My magic bag of endless pens.
Yeah. So, I'm only 3 hours.
Be there at 5:30.
It's up to your brother, dude.
Get her there at 5:30.
So,
I have an important
question. We're starting into systematic theology, which I'm very excited about. I sent you guys, like, a schedule of what we're covering each day. And today is prolegomena. Everybody say prolegomena.
Prolegomena.
Nice. These come from Greek words. all of these come from Greek words. Lego means I speak.
It means the buildable little things.
Legomena is a participle version.
Lego
so,
men, like the little people. Like,
the Wait, you step on them.
But with the A, so, with the A,
speaking,
back,
saying, right. And then pro is first. So, first sayings, first things said, first speakings. So this is the introductory things to theology. What do you need to say first to lay the groundwork to understand what we're talking about moving forward? So that's what today is. So the outline, we're going to talk about what theology is and the different types of theology that are out there. If you didn't know, there's lots of different types of theology. And then we'll talk a little bit about presuppositions, and there'll be essentially lots of definitions today. So there'll be words that you just kind of start getting familiar with because you'll hear them more as we're going forward in this series. I also, this is a preface, I want some back and forth. This prolegomena has the potential to be quite dry if you're not engaged. But if you are engaged and you're thinking, and you're saying, okay, so where is that going to go when we get deeper into theology? It's quite engaging and helpful. So ask questions, and I'll try, and we'll have a little bit of back and forth and discussion. Don't ever be afraid to stop me and say, I don't get that. Just explain it, please. Because you can't learn something if you don't ask.
That's true.
So,
what is that? You can't learn something if you don't ask?
Yeah.
It's not true.
That's not true.
Yeah, that's not true.
I disagree with you on that.
I will rephrase it. Asking questions is the best way to learn something.
I've never learned anything by not asking.
You'll learn less about don't ask questions.
There you go.
That's a better saying.
I'm just a better person. I'm just kidding. I'm definitely kidding.
First of all,
are you an Eric? No,
Steven is. What is Agnes? So first of all, the meaning of theology. We not so much in this group, I think, but in general church culture, theology has kind of a bad rap. Essentially, you hear the word, and people either get turned off, or they think, oh, somebody who likes theology is just judgmental and dogmatic, and they don't love people, and just care about being right, that sort of thing. Or they think, oh, theology is for other people to do, you know, the professional Christians, right? Not for me, just as a general believer in Christ. And people get paid to do that, and I don't need to worry about it. So hopefully one of the things you come out of this is realizing that everyone's a theologian. It's just a question of how good of a theologian are you. And then the other thing is to not be scared of theology. It's a helpful thing, and it's a life-giving thing. Theology helps to answer questions about life. And you get definitely peace from studying theology. Yeah.
You said that it depends on how good of a theologian you are. So, like, but there are good theologians who are equally good but disagree on things, right? Like, it doesn't mean that, like, if you're good, you're going to agree on the same things. It's just, like, they've looked into different
sort of. We're going to come back to that point in more depth. So, but, yeah, keep that in mind. But, yes, sort of. there's a whole slide devoted to that particular point.
There's
so
a slide for that.
To everyone's a theologian thing, there's a slide for that.
Don't
first
worry,
of Jack, all,
there's a slide
for what that. Does theology mean? These also come from Greek words. theos, which means God. So everybody say theos.
Theos.
You're learning Greek. It's wonderful. And
hey, I remember those words, and I took Greek like months ago.
Logos. Everybody say logos.
Logos.
Word. So you see Theo and Logo. The letters get a little bit switched around because putting it in English. But words about God. That's what the two root words literally mean. Words about God. Sayings about God. It's Theology is, here's some definitions for you, it's saying things about God. I'm trying to do this a little bit more upper crust, so you'll get more like a seminary sort of approach to theology. You're welcome. The Science and Facts of Divine Revelation, that's Charles Hodge. He is a well-known theologian from the 1800s. Wrote a great systematic theology. A rational discourse about God. I really like that definition. Has a few key points to it, right? Rational. There's something about theology that has to be reasonable, straightforward, and discourse. There has to be give and take. There has to be discussion in constructing theology. It can't be done in a vacuum. A discourse upon one specific subject, namely God. That's Lewis Berry Chafer. He's a founder of Dallas Theological Seminary, the seminary I attend, and the seminary that kind of founded Northwest Bible Church, or produced the pastors who founded Northwest Bible Church. So, influential in your personal church history is Lewis Berry Chafer. The systematized knowledge of God, Lewis Burkhoff, I think. Oh, no, I didn't end up bringing Burkhoff. Anybody want to offer a definition of theology based on these ways that you might try and express the idea? Words about God? What do you think?
The study of God.
The study of God. Well put. I agree. Any other? Just theology in general. How would you define it? No? That seems pretty good. The study of God. Nice, straightforward.
Well, that's me. Yeah.
Oh, something I forgot to mention.
Yes. Yes, Zach. Yes.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
This book, Basic Theology by Charles Ryrie, I considered buying you all your own copies for this series, but I added it up and it was going to cost me a little bit too much to do that. So if you want to buy this book for yourself, I highly, highly recommend it. Essentially, this series, I'm organizing it around Ryrie's structure in this book because it is one of the best systematic theologies for an introductory, easy-to-read layperson. It covers a lot, but it doesn't get too technical or confusing like Frame or some of the bigger... Like, if you were to read Chafer, this guy, you get a little bit blue in the face just because he's from 1900 and he likes to write big, confusing sentences. And
like that big, confusing
just sentence. Say what you mean. Ryrie does a great job of just saying what he means. So,
like the Dickens of theologians?
Yes.
Fantastic. Dickens. Charles Dickens.
So anyway, this is, I structured the whole series around Ryrie's basic theology's structure. Two concepts to consider in the meaning of theology. First of all, theology is intelligible. It has to have some sort of structure to it. Rational is the word that Geisler used. That's why I like that definition. Okay? It's not a study of something if it's just a cluster of random information that's not organized in any way. So, secondly, theology requires explanation. Thank you. I'm glad we have at least one Whovian in here.
exterminate!
No, explain. Explain.
I don't know, but that's what they do. That's what they say.
Theology requires explanation. It's not something that you can assume. The whole point of theology is that you're trying to explain further things that have not been fully explained. God himself has revealed certain things, and we're trying to organize that information and explain it in a way that makes it impactful for us, something that we can use and grow from. Right? Does everybody agree with those two concepts in theology? Okay. Notice so far we haven't talked about Christianity at all. Right, theology doesn't have to be distinctly Christian. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Two notes. So this is where the first one, everyone does theology, but not everyone does theology well. Theology, here's another definition of theology if you want to throw it onto your list of definitions. Thoughts about God.
That could be a book.
Answering the existential questions of life.
Also could be a book.
Why are we here? What are we doing? Where did we come from? Were we created? Were we not? Even atheists are theologians. They have some sort of answer to the question of, does God exist? And their answer is no. That's still a theological question and answer. It's just not a Christian theological question and answer. So, in answer to your earlier question, Zach, what makes someone a good theologian versus a bad theologian? Good theology is that which more accurately describes or instructs about the about God than what we would term bad theology. So,
right.
Whatever theology is closer to the actual truth, the actual reality of who God is, how he exists, that's better theology.
But isn't theology they're going on to see what that truth is? Right? Like, that's what they're trying to
Yeah, do. They're trying to construct the truth
okay.
As close, or explain it as close to as it really exists in the unintelligible
right.
realities of God.
So, there's always, I forget who the two people are, but I think it's Calvinist and
Calvin and Arminian?
Lutheran. Yeah. So, like, there's the differences, that's different, like, looks on theology, right?
Yeah.
So, does that mean that one of them is a bad theologian? Because, like, at that point, it's just...
I would say that one of them has to be a better theologian than the other. Because one of them
is right.
has to be, yeah, closer to the actual reality of who God is and how he works.
But, like, would it really be that big of a... Was that big of a deal?
Yeah, so there's that... At what point does it stop being super important, the differences? And
I feel like it depends on which thing you're talking about.
Yeah, and I haven't come up with a good answer to that question yet. At what point do the differences stop being as important as the other differences? We talked a little bit about that in the one when not many of you were here that day. It was great, the theological consistency test that we did. We talked a lot about that.
I did that. I really was there for that.
But yeah, I don't quite have an answer, but I am confident in saying that one of those is a better theologian than the other, and I'm inclined to say, based on my study and what God has revealed, I think Calvin is a better theologian than Jacobus Arminius was. I think he got closer to the truth, the reality. But the truth is fundamentally unknowable in its entirety in this life. That's something that we kind of recognize, that God has not fully revealed himself. He does not dwell with us. And that's part of something we learn from the Bible. He will one day. And we'll find out who was the better theologian, I think, once we get there. We'll get there. Oh, now that I'm talking to you face-to-face, God, turns out John Calvin was better than Jacob Arminius.
Y'all weren't even going the right direction at
all. We were all off, like, in Antarctica somewhere. And but yeah, does that kind of answer the question? Which ones?
Yeah.
What do you think so far about the idea of everyone's a theologian? It's just some of them are a lot worse than others.
Yeah. That's right. Makes sense.
Okay. I concur.
Okay.
Such large words. Right?
No, it's very short.
We're going to get into types of theology next, though.
Actually, it's seven letters.
So, there's four that we're going to go in depth, and then other is kind of a catch-all. But to start off with, Christian theology. So, this is theological systems, studies, ideas put forward about God that is distinctly Christian. A good definition from Ryrie was the rational interpretation of the Christian faith. Okay, so now we have its theology, but it's particularly how it relates to people who call themselves Christians, people who follow the Christ, right? Jesus. Has to be related to that guy somehow for it to be Christian theology. So, your Buddhist theology is not Christian theology, but they're both theology. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to kind of narrow down the field of vision.
Subcategorize it.
So theology
subcategorize,
is the,
yeah.
What if you don't have a God? And would it still be theology?
It would be atheology.
It would be atheistic theology.
Okay, that's close.
Atheology. Because, I kind of like it.
Because like they'll have, like, Buddhism, for example, they don't have like gods per se. They have a leader that they follow.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and that's, so you're touching on a good point, that theology, as we've defined it so far, trying to narrow the field, has a very specific related to the study of God. It gets used in a lot broader ways than that. I think you could all recognize that. The word theology gets thrown around in many different ways, sometimes to just express what they really mean when they say theology is philosophy. Just any kind of love of knowledge, which is kind of different.
Technically, atheists do believe in a God. They just believe that they are their own God.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
In a way, so.
Yeah, I believe everybody has a God. It's just some of them are inanimate. Mm-hmm. there was another example I was going to throw out there. And I'm losing it. It's going further away. Oh, yeah, okay.
You found it.
We would categorize, like, existential questions, like, where did we come from, right? That's a theological question, although it doesn't necessarily incorporate God in the question itself. It's just that the vast majority of answers incorporate God, right? So it gets categorized as theology in terms of what kind of question it is. But it's not really, by the definition we gave earlier, the study or system of rational discourse about God. It doesn't quite fall into that definition. So just give me a little bit of give and take here as we're going. But I want to try and keep more of the strict definition, things related to God. But we might broaden it out in different times. Things that make Christian theology versus some other kind of theology. First of all, the Bible. Christians claim that the Bible is God's self-revelation. So we're going to look to that as a source for our theology. Look for where are we going to find answers to these questions? The Bible is going to be one of them. Christian theology also looks to church history quite often. Say, what have other Christians down throughout the ages, how have they answered these questions? What have they said about these topics? Does that help us or hinder us? Can we learn something from them? So that's going to be another source that Christian theology looks to. When we did church history, we looked at the creeds. Major source of Christian theology is in the creeds. Didn't come around until the 400s, but were essential in developing what Christians believe and Christian theology. And then logic. Unfortunately, not all theologies use logic. I had to put that one in there.
That's not logical.
Nonsense and no sense.
There are other types of theology. So we've already kind of discussed this. There's atheistic theology. There's Buddhist theology. There's different ways to subcategorize and focus your theology. So example would be American theology or feminist theology or liberation theology. Liberation theology, Gustavo Gutierrez is kind of the founding father of liberation theology, is saying we want to look at God as, in particular, a salvation from bondage sort of focus. So everything we say about God is going to be with that bent. It gets, applied in terms of slavery quite often. We're looking at God's development in his relation to the institution of slavery throughout the ages. I'm talking slavery way back in, 1500 BC kind of slavery. And how has it changed and developed throughout the ages?
Like the Egyptians?
From, the beginning of time, almost. Nations have been enslaving each other. So...
It happens.
I'm better than you.
So it's just looking at God through me.
That lens.
Okay. It's not like saying that God is or that God isn't. It's just looking at what the people of those certain situations are thinking of God.
Yes. It's just how do they think about God? How do they answer these questions? And then usually it comes up, so feminist theology would be another example, that saying how has God related to women throughout the ages and what does God think about women? And usually those kinds of theologies, the ones that I listed, ones that will put some sort of a hook word that doesn't seem to really relate to theology until it's explained, there's some sort of an agenda behind it. They're saying, we want to prove some point about our social movement or our culture, and so we're going to develop this theology, study of God, answers to these questions that help us. So I despise feminist theology. I try to read it, and it just makes me mad. So they'll do things like, they'll reverse the word order in the Bible and say, in the beginning God created Eve and Adam.
Well,
that doesn't make any sense.
They want to remove any kind of gender-specific pronouns in the Bible because it's not inclusive. Those sorts of things are all feminist theology ideas. It's
selfish people.
How do you even talk?
It's agenda-driven is my problem with it.
You can't
so quite often these theologies are agenda-driven. They want to prove some point about themselves. Not they don't want to discern the truth as it was presented by God. They want to enforce a truth upon God. And I get angry on God's behalf for that.
But, so does that mean they don't have any feministic Spanish translation of the Bible?
Yeah, I don't even know how they do that.
You're right. Did you just use the masculine?
Oh my gosh. It's like the new, the Latinx. Have you seen that?
No.
That's the new... Instead of saying Latina or Latino so that it's not not offensive to be gender-driven, you put Latinx. So it's a gender-neutral way of describing a Latino.
Celtic Latinx.
It's just silly.
It's all very selfish.
Yeah.
The whole thing is.
Yeah.
That's what bothered me about it. Except that word. It's very selfish.
All of these worldviews do theology, though. All of them try and answer these questions. Who is God? How does he work? What does he care about? And they have different answers to those questions. From this point on, though, in the entire series, we're going to be dealing specifically with Christian theology. Surprise, right? Shock and all.
That's insane. I wanted to study Buddhist theology.
Yeah. You're welcome to go do that, but
not
I'm not going to do that here.
Get it out of my house.
I would say, I encourage you to go and study it so that you know what they say. I would also encourage you not to believe it because it's not true. I'd have to build up some more argumentation for that point, but just take it for what it's worth. Now, there are other kinds of theology. Biblical theology, which is my favorite kind of theology. But not what we're going to be doing. Surprise. Particularly focuses on the Bible. It doesn't try to draw in any other things about the world, really. It says we want to study particularly the text. What did the authors say in their original context? What did they mean then? And trying to sort of systematize it that way. We essentially did biblical theology together when we did the story of the Bible. We were doing biblical theology.
But not the story. We didn't do the story.
Yeah. when we did the story of the Bible in here, right? Prepping for Riggins. That was biblical theology, what we were doing.
Yeah, well, we didn't write it, but we wrote it.
Trying to see how the Bible organizes its revelation of God and draw truth from it. Particularly good biblical theology. We'll study the original languages. You'll use the original languages. It emphasizes the progress of the self-revelation of God in the Bible, not necessarily in the world. The theologies that will do that would be like systematic theology, which is what we're going to do. It correlates everything. It just says we're going to try and systematize all of the information that we can confidently say is from God and put it into a system to try and organize it and answer questions.
That's hurting my head. Where it starts.
What do you... What?
No, it's fine. Don't worry about
it.
I just don't know how it starts.
Okay. What? Alright, I won't worry about it.
I guess I'll look at it.
You're talking about the Lego words?
Yes. The words? Do you think I was talking about the words?
No.
Oh, no, I was talking about the Legos.
Why is that
okay.
It's trippy because I don't know where it starts.
It's so trippy.
It
starts with the blue.
Yeah.
But does it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wait. You say it but does it start in the middle?
Okay, so systematic theology tries to systematize all of the information we have. I like the analogy of Legos for systematic theology. It's taking all the pieces and trying to put them together in a way that is intelligible.
Yeah,
obviously not that intelligible,
trying.
But more intelligible. It involves both biblical and historical theology, which we're about to learn about in a second. But it focuses on the structure of doctrines and dogmas. You guys know the difference between doctrines and dogmas?
Dogma.
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 Like different
go for it.
Idea, I think.
It was like personal. That kind of doctrines.
I saw a comedy called Dogma with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, but they legitimately, like, it was about the theology, like, and Chris Rock was in it, and he was talking about...
The great theologian?
Yeah, he was the 13th disciple that they didn't mention in my whole family. But basically, he just said that it was, like, about how we shouldn't have beliefs, we should just have ideas and stick with those ideas or something like that.
That's
I don't
not
know.
A belief!
Like, just have an idea, and we shouldn't, like, go to war about it. I don't know. I thought that's what
Barbara
was, but I might be completely wrong. So.
Yeah, not quite.
You were... like, the ideas that other people have about something, not necessarily the ideas, like, the air that something has, kind of.
The air?
Like...
Or error.
No, like when...
That's dogmatic. So that's...
Words today.
That's dogma turned into a... description. So that, this is good. So we're learning. You could also put, so before doctrines, put opinions. They're essentially the range of insistence upon its truth by a group of people. So dogma are the things that Christians throughout all of history have always taught, always believed are essential. These are the, if you're dogmatic on something, you're saying, I'm not giving on this, period, full stop. If you don't believe this, you are not a Christian, right? Or you are not part of this group. Whatever your group is, there's dogmas in every religion and every ideology. But that's what your dogma is, the central core essential things. And Christianity things usually those end up being Trinity, salvation, some sort of atonement theory, used to be sinfulness of humanity. And that's progressing towards doctrine, unfortunately. But so those are dogmas. Doctrines are the things that the large groups of people will agree on, but there's still diversity in the bigger umbrella. So you have Catholic doctrine and Protestant doctrine. Many would still call us all Christians if we agree on the dogmas. Unfortunately, we don't agree on the dogmas much anymore either, so... But another way to do so, you got Baptist doctrine and Methodist doctrine. Baptists say, if you're going to baptize, you have to dunk that person. Otherwise, they're not actually baptized, and you got to go do it again. Whereas...
Stay under for 5 minutes.
There are other denominations that sprinkle, right? They say you can just sprinkle water on somebody, and that's a baptism. So those are two different doctrines about baptism. And large groups of people will agree on them, but we're not going to say that that is definitional to Christianity. You with me? Mm-hmm. Whereas opinion is a step even further away, where it's like, yeah, sure, you believe in the peccability versus the impeccability of Christ. I think I've talked about that with you guys, have I not?
I think so.
Could Jesus have sinned?
Yeah.
Was he able to at all, or was he not because he was God? Okay, that's a step further into the realm of opinions, where really it's kind of up to the individual. And it doesn't really super matter. How do you determine what's dogma, what's doctrine, and what's opinion?
That does matter.
There aren't any hard and fast... No, it's not a question of did he sin, it's could he have sinned.
Oh,
no.
Both people who take impeccability say, no, he didn't sin. We're not saying that. But could he have?
Oh,
was he
yeah,
able
so
to?
True.
Yeah.
But I mean, like,
was he even able to
happen, so
sin? Yes.
I mean that.
Yes.
It's kind of one of those things.
That's something that lies in the realm of opinion, so we don't bother splitting churches over it.
There was the possibility of the sin, though. It's not saying that he had sin, but there
it's
was
not
sin.
Sin.
Yeah, that was an example. So that was an example. That was an example of something that we don't need to talk about too much right now. I love having those conversations. But
no, we're not talking about that right now.
Those would be in the realm of opinion. Everybody clear on the difference between opinion, doctrine, and dogma?
Yes.
So we're going to be looking at both doctrines and dogmas. You'll get essentially a mix of those, and I'll try and distinguish when something's dogma versus when it's doctrine. The distinctions are blurred, right? This is more of a spectrum than a firm category or a basket that you throw things into, because some things... large groups of people will differ on how important it is, and so unfortunately it's a soft science, which bugs me that theology is a soft science and I like it so much. I wish it were a hard science where you just, this is the answer, period. You don't always get that. You guys know the difference between hard and soft sciences? Did I just say something else that was...
I think I get it.
Psychology is a soft science because it's like, it's not something that you can test and say, oh yeah, okay, 60% magnesium, there you go. Hard sciences are things where you can test and observe the results, and it's standardized every time.
So like chemistry or...
Like carbon.
Like things that are microscopic or proposed are treated as a hard science, but are not actually.
That's one of the big problems today, is that people don't know the difference between hard and soft sciences. So they treat things that are soft sciences as if they were hard sciences. Quantum physics is a soft science, but it has the word physics in it, so everybody thinks it's a hard science.
Because physics is a hard science.
Because physics is a hard science.
But yes. Technically, aren't some parts of theology a hard science?
Yeah, some parts of theology are harder than others.
in multiple ways. Yeah.
So basically, soft sciences are just sciences that people can't necessarily prove.
Yeah. It really just comes down to the opinion or the preponderance of the evidence.
So they're basically kind of theory?
Yeah. Yeah. Historical science, another way to put it. Anyway, everybody clear on doctrines, dogmas, opinions? So, systematic theology focuses on trying to put edges on things, right? Where these are all spectrums, systematic theology is trying to put edges on things and put them together, put them in boxes so that we can understand them better, organize it. Historical theology is a fun thing to do. It focuses on what have other theologians said throughout the ages. So, it involves biblical and systematic theology often, but you're particularly looking at theology through the eyes of another historical figure. You guys know these guys? Anybody know any of these guys up here?
That's
Columbus is up there.
That's Martin Luther, yeah.
Not Columbus. What's that guy?
John Calvin, yeah.
What's that guy?
I don't know.
Not Thomas Edison.
Wait, who's the guy on the bottom with the most fucking eyes?
Him? That's Charles Ryrie. That's the guy who wrote this. That's why I threw him up there.
Tree.
He's one of my favorite theologians.
I can't remember what his name is.
This is Augustine. Augustine, right? Wrote the Confessions, City of God. The guy who... heard the little girl singing, take up and read. Yeah, he's one of the greatest Christian theologians to ever live. Augustine. I didn't put Tertullian.
That.
You got Jonathan Edwards. You guys know the name Jonathan Edwards?
Yes.
He's a great American theologian. He wrote the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It's probably what he's most well known for. First Great Awakening.
What?
That's Aquinas.
So not
that no, that's not the guy from Breaking Bad. No.
Which guy are you talking about?
What guy?
That guy's Thomas Aquinas.
Who do you think that looks like? For
he is kind of the first guy to write a systematic theology, Summa Theologica. He's a Catholic theologian.
What do you mean by the first person to systemat? Like, what was different about that one that was different about the others?
He put it into doctrines. He started putting names on things. Started. Trying to systematize it, kind of in a way that we recognize it.
So organize it and everything.
Yeah, there's kind of 12 recognized sections of theology, which are the sections of our series. So he's one of the first ones to come up with that kind of thing. So historical theology is particularly, what did these guys say about this? It's another step removed away from the actual revelation of God. But it's helpful, because we don't know everything. You do theology in community, and you community from the past and from the present. You ask questions and see what other people, how they answer. I think that was the end of the... All right. Here's where the philosophy kind of comes in.
Presuppositions.
Presuppositions. So...
Is that game called... Snake, I think. Is it like pieces cut out?
No, not at all. That's Hebrew.
No. But then it's the last name.
That's Hebrew.
Yes, that's the Tetragrammaton.
So yes,
it's okay. Good tip.
Thanks, please.
These are some of the presuppositions I'm going forward. You guys know what a presupposition is?
Like a
Think of break the word apart. So this is good practice in philology. Yeah. So suppose is one of those words, right? You see the word suppose in there? What does it mean to suppose something?
To think something without complete knowledge?
Yeah. To think it ahead of... to think it, to have the idea, I suppose. Pre suggests before, ahead of time. So what are the things that you're assuming, supposing, ahead of time? That's what presuppositions are. So some of the presuppositions I'm going into theology with are things like truth is objectable and knowable through observation. We can discern the truth, right? That's a presupposition I'm going into the revelation of God with when I start doing my theology. I had to come to that conclusion through reason and argumentation. But it's also, that's, I think, a presupposition that everyone actually believes, even the people who say that they don't. Because to deny it is to affirm it. But I digress. Another presupposition. God exists.
Say that again, to deny it is to affirm it?
Yeah.
To say that we can't know truth is a truth.
To say that there is no objective truth is an objective truth. So,
like saying there is no absolute?
There is no objective truth and I know it. Truth is objective and... Wait a second. God exists and has revealed himself in the Bible. Another presupposition I'm going into this theology with. I'm just going to show my hand. That's where I start with. I do believe that that book is written by the creator of the universe. And that the words are true in their original context.
Well, by review.
To the original audience.
Hold on, that's some.
And that is a big.
That's some controversial stuff right there.
That is a big presupposition. And you're joking, it's not controversial in here. That is an extremely controversial statement by and large in the world.
By revealing himself, what do you mean,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so obvious. In the Bible.
People are idiots, Benjamin.
Yeah, but some people just straight up think, like, yeah, the Bible's a book that somebody wrote, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of...
Like the story.
Yeah.
Like, for us, the Bible's so normal. You know,
we're going to do a little bit of proving that presupposition when we do the bibliology, talking about the study of the Bible. But and we'll start with that, I think. I forget what order I put it in. Lastly, reality is, and I worded that intentionally so... So this, you already noticed, does anybody know what this says?
Reality is.
Yod, hey, vav, hey.
It does say, Yod, hey, vav, hey. Those are Hebrew letters.
I thought you were just mumbling.
Yahweh. Anybody?
Yahweh.
Yeah.
Also known as the Tetragrammaton, this is the name of God.
Is that the four letters that, like, they wouldn't say it if they spelled it right?
Yeah.
They wouldn't say it. If
hey, what was that? Was that thing
yeah,
you just
like,
said?
If
Tetragrammaton?
They wouldn't say
Tetragrammaton.
It such a big deal. You know what I mean? It was the name of God, so they wouldn't say it.
Like how they wouldn't say I am.
Yeah, and the...
Is that kind of the same thing?
Yeah. So, yeah, what does that translate to? That's what it transliterates to.
Oh, right.
What does it translate to? What is when God reveals his name to Moses, so the people of Israel will ask me...
I am that I am. I am that I am. That's what it says.
Tell them I am sent you, right? That's,
I is what I is.
That means I am.
Dude, that's
right. Right.
Wait, is that what that says?
Yes.
Cool.
It's funny
because
I feel like you said
that.
Are you talking
about
that?
Oh, that's on your arm.
No way.
On your arm.
Hey, that tattoo you got for everybody that you told us about?
We already talked about that.
What is it named, though? I am. Okay, think about that in terms of grammar. What does that mean?
Is it like a truth? Isn't it like a truth statement?
Yeah. What is he saying about himself?
That he exists,
as opposed to not existing, right? I think the fact that God revealed God's name is, first of all, it's personal. It's first person, I. And then it's the verb to be, right? To exist. So two major truths about God summed up only in his name. First of all, he exists where others don't. Yahweh, the God of Israel, actually does exist. And he's personal. He's not some distant force who doesn't care or doesn't have any kind of personality or will. He is a person, I. and he is.
So I am in.
That's actually really cool.
Yeah. It translates to Yahweh.
It's like Silver Call. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the word Yahweh. We don't know the actual vowels because they've been lost, but it means I am. It means I am that I am.
I like that. It also affirms that reality is because you can't exist in something that's almost
exactly existent. So yeah, and that's where reality is a clever way of saying God, right? His existence is what makes reality a thing. It is because he is.
Mm, that's cool.
And we is because he is.
Yeah.
Yes.
You was because
Love
we am.
Exactly.
Wait.
So those are some of the presuppositions I'm going in with. There are probably others that will reveal themselves as we go. Anybody else think of some presuppositions that we might end up recognizing we have as we
The Bible.
As we start doing theology? What are we presupposing going into theology?
The Bible is true.
All of the books were inspired by God.
Was that
Presuppositions we have on the daily, or just about theology?
Yeah.
I think reveals himself in the Bible covers just about all of them.
That's all I want to try to do is go in with just these. We might find that we end up having others, unfortunately.
Good riddance.
So long, farewell.
Hey, Josh, if I'm late, if I'm out there.
You haven't planned on it?
Are
you planning on going?
I can do that. It will kill me, but I can do that.
Are you leaving too?
No, I was just making
a joke. Yeah. We're not done. They're just leaving to be at church. There's more on this handout, isn't there?
I don't know. I haven't been following the handout.
Yeah, but I have been having
No. Bye, guys. Have fun.
Here is where a lot of definitions are going to come
in. Bye, Josh.
So they're going to miss all these definitions. They're going to be so confused next week.
Losers.
Yeah.
Well, if they actually took them. I mean.
So, this is something that one of my profs puts up on the board every once in a while to kind of remind us. In doing theology, lots of times we do theology in this order. We go systematic theology. We start there. We say, what do we know about God? And we turn to what other people have said about God and what we think we know about God. And then we say, now let's look at his revelation and exposit it and explain it. And then we'll apply it. What's wrong with that method?
There's more for it.
If you didn't have this whole thing in front of you, if you just thought, start with your systematic theology, then read the passage, and then apply it. What's wrong with that method?
Experiences influence what God is telling you.
Yeah.
That's good.
You're starting with the wrong thing, right? The only way that we know anything about God is because he revealed it. So, this is what I call the proper order of theology, of application. You might also switch systematic and historical theology depending on how you understand the two, but we'll keep going forward and then we'll deal with that. First of all, hermeneutics. That's where you start. This is your philosophy, really. This is, how am I going to interpret the revelation that God has given me? Right? You have to determine how you're going to do that first. So I argue that it's best to start with a literal grammatical interpretation of the Bible. Did that track?
Yes.
What's a literal grammatical interpretation of the Bible?
Reading it and taking the Bible's word for it.
Yeah. Taking the Bible at its word. If it says something, then the words, whatever the words mean, that's what it means. As opposed to, common would be an allegorical interpretation of the Bible. We see this a lot throughout church history. Say things like, the seven times that they marched around the walls of Jericho actually represent the seven spirits of God. And we draw truth from that. Every time that they marched around, it was one complete revolution. And then we relate that to the Christian life.
It takes so much more effort than just taking it at its word, though.
Yeah. That would be an example of an allegorical interpretation of the story of Jericho. There are other things like ones that's a little bit more blatant allegorical interpretation, saying Jonah wasn't a real guy who was really eaten by a great fish.
But he wasn't eaten.
That's a fictional story. It's a fictional story that you know teaches a point, a spiritual point. The fish represents the greatness of the trials of life, and Jonah represents all of humanity, and Nineveh represents hell.
Not really anything pointing to an allegorical interpretation.
Yeah, there's nothing in the text that tells you to do that of Jonah, so I think it's wrong to do that. Yeah.
Would you say there's reason to take some of the things allegorically, or do you think it's just an excuse to not, like, to dismiss Christianity in some places?
I do think that certain allegorical interpretations are valid, and it's when the text tells you, gives you the clues that an allegory is happening. Actually, I have a whole presentation on allegorical interpretation we could go through. We could speed through it at the end of this to help with that idea. But and the short version is when the text tells you that an allegory is happening, take it allegorically. With the Jonah example, there's just nowhere from the beginning of the book of Jonah to the end of it that seems to tell you anywhere that this should not be taken as a historical narrative.
Whereas when Jesus says a parable,
The context itself says, okay, we don't have to take this as historical narrative. When Jesus appears to John and gives him a vision in Revelation, right? Most of the book of Revelation, people would argue, interpret it allegorically because Jesus appeared and he's giving a vision. There's some validity to that. Some of the things in Revelation are allegorical. The woman and the dragon, chapter 12. It seems to suggest, he says, a sign appeared to me. Okay, that's a phrase that clues you in that an allegory is about to take place. So we take the next section of the passage allegorically. The point I'm getting at is you let the text tell you when an allegory is happening. You don't put an allegory onto the text. That's the hermeneutic that I approach the text with. Others would disagree with me on that. So where you start with your hermeneutic is going to determine the trajectory of all of the rest of this process. So your hermeneutic is important. How are you reading the text? Moving forward with our theology, I'm going to be reading the text with a literal grammatical interpretation. Since we want to take it literally, what did the words mean in their original context, the original audience? That's what they meant. So, after that, you do your exegesis. All of these come from Greek words, by the way.
No way.
Exegesis means drawing out ex and ergos, or... I'm not going to guess because I forgot what the other Greek word was. As opposed to what's called eisegesis, which is reading an interpretation into the text. You draw out the meaning from the words that were there. Right? All words have some specific meaning when they're spoken. They have some intent that the speaker intended to communicate an idea with. So your job is to take those words, draw out that intended meaning. Okay? That's exegesis. I'm starting to lose some of you guys. Big words. Long process. I don't like it. Bear with me. Exposition is explaining the meaning. So once you have the meaning, what did the original author mean by the words that he used? Then you say, how does this fit in, and how do I explain and exposit this to flesh out the meaning, to keep it consistent with the rest of the revelation? After you do your exposition, then you do your biblical theology. You say, how does this relate to all the rest of the Bible? How does this fit into the narrative of the Bible, the major themes of the Bible as a whole? What point is it making within the full revelation, the full written revelation of God? After you look at your biblical theology, then you compare it to other historical theologies. You say, does this interpretation line up with what lots of other people have said? Okay, if it doesn't, why doesn't it? There might be a good reason to reject what a historical figure has said about that particular interpretation. But if you are standing in isolation, you finish your biblical theology, and then you look and you see that not another theologian has ever said this, and it's something like Jesus was from the planet Krypton, you did your exposition wrong. you got off somewhere in your biblical theology. If the vast majority of Christendom disagrees with your conclusion, I seriously doubt your conclusion. You might still be right, It might have been that 99% of the church has gotten it wrong throughout all of history, but that's a very slim chance. So historical theology is important. It's not the be-all, end-all.
Wait, so going back to the biblical theology real quick.
Yeah.
I guess this is, when you said biblical theology, you're and then compiling the biblical revelation, you're talking about going to other passages in the Bible.
Yes. Okay. It's comparing throughout, how does this fit into the narrative, the story arc of the Bible itself. After you do all that, then you do your systematic theology. You fit it all together. And you do a little bit of back and forth with your systematic and historical theology. You start systematizing it, putting it together, and then you compare to what other people have said. Okay, they systematized it like this. Okay, are we agreeing, disagreeing? If I'm disagreeing, do I have good reasons to disagree? Then you go back and you systematize more. Finally, after you've done all of that, you get application. How does it now impact my life? What do I do about it? Since I've done diligently, I've done theology well, how does this affect me? And I will say, by and large, if you do your theology well, the application just naturally flows. It just kind of pours out from the theology itself. That's one of the marvelous things about our Creator. He almost gives it to you. Once you find the answer, and of course I know how to apply it. So I am a sinner in need of grace, and the Bible says, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved, and I need to be saved. Then what must I do? Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, application. Done. What do I do? Right. What we just did there was hermeneutics, exegesis, exposition. We kind of skipped over the biblical and historical theology, went to systematic theology, and then we found an application. That was what we just did was theology. Really quick. It gets bigger than that, obviously. Does this process make sense? This is a process that I've found to be tried and true. This is what I consider a good way to do theology, so that you will not be in error the vast majority of the time. Something else I got to admit up front, Josh isn't here to make that silly joke. Probably, I would guess, by extremely proud and arrogant measures, about 20% of the systematic theology I teach you will be wrong. I just don't know what 20% that is. Right. I've done my best with the revelation I have, tried to systematize it and present it to you, but yeah, probably about 20% would be my guess when I'm being particularly arrogant, probably closer to 30, 40, 50% of what I teach you will be wrong. We'll get to heaven and God will slap me upside the head like he'll do the Gibbs slap and say, are you kidding me? And he'll pull out a Bible and he'll point to it and say, read that. And I'll be like, you're right, I'm sorry.
You'll be like, you're right, God.
I thought I was inherent. Joshua kept telling me I was inherent, so I guess I just believed him. Just went to my head.
I don't know everything, and you don't either. So having that humility, we're going to do the best we have. We're going to try and be as good of theologians as we can, always realizing we'll get some stuff wrong. Just we will pray that the grace of God is upon us, and He is so gracious. Doesn't mean that we don't do the theology. That's the kicker. That's kind of what happens a lot with the Christian life. If you didn't realize. Things you don't like about it doesn't mean you don't do it.
Why can't we just say the Bible's true and just throw it away?
And not really believe it. Those are my works cited. Last little thing is the supplemental bibliography, which I gave. So these are some good recommendations I would make for people who have done systematic theology and biblical theology before you. So some of these examples. Actually, I don't think I put this one on the list, but this is an example of a historical theology, particularly about the Trinity. So this is just saying, what have all the people throughout history said about the Trinity? Let's compare everything that they've written and draw some conclusions. So this is a particularly historical theology. You're welcome to borrow this one if you want. Some of these you can't borrow because I need them to prep these lessons. But the Bible, I think, is your first and major source when you're doing systematic theology. Yeah. Basic Theology by Charles Ryrie is the first one I recommend to you. Like I said, I seriously, highly, highly recommend you get this book. There's something that more liturgical churches, you guys know what the word liturgical means? It's okay. Just whenever I say a word you don't know, just tell me, because I don't, I like to explain words.
Isn't the Lutheran church liturgical?
Lutheran church is more liturgical, yeah. Liturgy are those kind of high church rituals, processes, things that you go through, right? So more liturgical churches, the Catholic Church is a liturgical church, the Roman Catholic Church, they do something called catechesis. They catechize. They essentially make you go through a course kind of like this, systematic theology, and then you kind of sign something that says, yes, I agree with these. I'm officially a member of this church. I have been catechized. And what you do is you receive a catechism, which is a little book. It's essentially a systematic theology of that church's doctrine. Right? Most Protestant churches just don't do that anymore. We look down on it. I think there's some merit to it. There's obviously some danger with catechizing, but I think that there's definitely good things about it. So you maybe think of Ryrie's Basic Theology as like a catechesis. It's something that you can look to and you say, I have a question. Where can I go to find an organized, easy answer to this question? Who will have done his due diligence to walk through theology correctly.
Wait, why did you say there's some danger in catechizing?
Because your doctrines start to become dogmas when you start catechizing. So the catechesis, the little book that they give you that has all of the answers, right, starts to replace the Bible. And you start to look to that for answers instead of the Bible. And you start to believe everything just because this book that some guy in your church wrote that says he had all the answers instead of believing the revelation of God. That's the danger of catechizing, I think. But there's obviously merit to it in that you get answers to questions that everybody has and nobody really wants to ask.
So. If someone good teaches it, they recognize that all the answers actually came from the Bible.
Yeah.
And tells you about it.
They teach you the same thing, yeah. That this isn't 100% right. That one is. So that one's the Bible, by the way.
I thought that was your diary.
Can I bring Who Needs Theology with me? I found it. Yeah, there it is. Who Needs Theology? A nice little introductory book to how do we start thinking about theology. If this was kind of over your head, you'd never even thought about how do we start doing these things, how do we start coming up with these things, what is theology at all? Good little book. Another one, a little book for new theologians. Nice, easy to read introductory books that just kind of get you used to thinking about theology. I brought a couple other examples. This is an example of a biblical theology. A biblical theology of the Old Testament. So this is specifically just Genesis through Malachi. This doesn't do the whole Bible. But it's by Roy Zook. He's a pretty solid theologian, in my opinion. Nice biblical theology of the Old Testament. You can borrow this one if you want. Bible Knowledge Commentary is a really good book. Anyway, these are all... I realize most of these, you're just sitting here going, why are you telling me about this? This is the kind of thing that 6 years from now, when you have a big question, you might look back at this and say, oh yeah, there was a list of books that Stephen recommended that I should get. And then you go find it. You go on Amazon. Oh, I can get this book for $6 and read it and find an answer to my question. You won't care about this right now. I recognize that. That's okay. Don't worry about it. Just remember that it's there. The last would be my recommendations for systematic theology. So kind of the heavier hitters, the big dogs. Lewis Berry Chafer, that guy who's the Charles Dickens of theologians, right? His is an 8-volume set, so you get this big.
Of course it is.
Yeah. Charles Hodge, he's another guy I quoted throughout the thing, right? His is a 3-volume set. It's one of the cornerstone systematic theologies that really did a great job for the Protestant post-Reformation Protestant churches. How do we systematize our theology? These are all ones that I would recommend highly for that. John Frame's Systematic Theology I brought. I haven't quite gotten through this one yet, but I've read a good bit of it, and I like John Frame. I've read others of his books, so he's an interesting writer. You can't borrow that one, though, because I need it for prepping lessons.
That's quite a
darn.
Book.
Sorry.
I knew you were all
excited to read that book.
So ready to borrow the systematic theology. You guys laughed. I hated reading when I was a kid, and it wasn't until I picked up systematic theologies and started reading them that I started liking reading at all. Because I was like, oh, these people are actually saying something important. Everything else to me seemed like, why are you bothering to make me read? That seems like work. I'm only going to read if it's something really important. And theology is the most important thing that you can ever read about. So it got me to like reading, and now I like reading for fun.
I like reading.
I said,
yeah.
How can someone not like reading?
Yeah.
That's
like,
not time for
anymore. I used to hate it, mostly because I was bad at it, and then I got better at it.
Well, it took me like 6 months to read a 400-page book. I'm not very good at it, but I enjoy it.
What time is it? 4:30. Okay.
You can read really
yeah.
slow.
No,
two options at this point. I guess there's three options at this point. We can break up into prayer, which is what I had intended to do with the last 30 minutes. We can go through that quick little PowerPoint on allegorical interpretations, or we can just leave early. So those are your three options. Ends at 5.
I was wrong. I'm sorry.
Leah, you're so wrong.
I'm just bad at life.
I'm
so,
great at life.
Everybody remember the three options?
Yes.
Prayer time, allegorical interpretation, PowerPoint, or leaf.
We should do prayer time.
So everybody pick one in your mind.
Wait.
I picked one out loud.
If you're nor there, I'll defer to the group.
Then just don't vote.
I picked mine out loud.
Okay. Everyone pick one in your mind. Close your eyes.
No, it wasn't pee time, Cameron.
Close your eyes.
My decision will
close,
not be swayed.
Close your eyes.
No. I will not.
Come on, Nathan.
Those who vote. It's not about your decision being swayed. It's about other people being self-conscious about people watching what they vote for.
Whatever.
Me neither.
I don't really care.
Those who vote for prayer time, raise your hand.
I'll be watching you.
Three, okay. Those who vote for allegorical interpretation presentation, raise your hand.
You can't vote twice, Caleb.
He has his eyes open.
Four, and those who vote for leave early, raise your hand. Caleb voted for all three. All right. All right, we'll look at allegorical interpretation then. Let me see if I can find it.
Welcome for those who vote.
I didn't let the pressure build up.
Well,
you're supposed to twist from the other hand.
What?
Like twist with the other hand.
What?
So I'll upload this one on today's thing also. There's a video in this. So.
Next target too.
To set my sound. Okay. So this presentation was for a class, excuse me, where I had to explain what the allegorical interpretation was and then give a proper explanation of Ezekiel 16, which is one big allegory. So we may or may not get to the Ezekiel 16 portion where we start applying these things, but at least get through the first half where it explains what allegorical interpretation is. So here's the outline. What is an allegory? And then the other question, how do you know Ezekiel 16 is an allegory, and how do you interpret Ezekiel 16 allegory? How do you do it? Start out with, what is an allegory? Oh, man, I don't even have my notes. I'm going to have to see if I remember these things. Oh, yeah, okay, that's just the outline. So first we're going to look at a definition, then we're going to look at the nature of metaphors, then the truth
truths about metaphors and allegories. Trying to flesh out these ideas. What are allegories? How do they apply to biblical interpretation? To start with, though, I have a little video clip to watch from a movie called Dead Poets Society that kind of explains a fear that I have with explaining allegorical interpretations in the way that I'm about to. So, to that end.
Page 21 of the introduction. Mr. Perry, we read the opening paragraph of the preface entitled Understanding Poetry.
Understanding Poetry by Dr. J. Evans Pritchard, PhD. To fully understand poetry, we must first be fluent with its meter, rhyme, and figures of speech, then ask two questions. One, how artfully has the objective of the poem been rendered? And two, how important is that objective? Question one rates the poem's perfection. Question two rates its importance. And once these questions have been answered, determining the poem's greatness becomes a relatively simple matter. If the poem's score for perfection is plotted on the horizontal of a graph, and its importance is plotted on the vertical, then calculating the total area of the poem yields the measure of its greatness. A sonnet by Byron might score high on the vertical, but only average on the horizontal. A Shakespearean sonnet, on the other hand, would score high both horizontally and vertically, yielding a massive total area, thereby revealing the poem to be truly great. As you proceed through the poetry in this book, practice this rating method. As your ability to evaluate poems in this manner grows, so will your enjoyment and understanding of poetry.
Excrement. That's what I think of Mr. J. Evans Pritchard. I'm not laying pipe. We're talking about poetry. How can you describe poetry like American bandstand? Well, I like Byron. I give him a 42, but I can't dance to it. I want you to rip out that page. Go on. Rip out the entire page. You hear me? Rip it out. Rip it out! Thank you, Mr. Dalton. Gentlemen, tell you what, not just tear out that page, tear out the entire introduction. I want it gone. History. Leave nothing of it. Rip it out! Rip! Be gone, J. Evans Pritchard, PhD. Rip! Rip the tear! Rip it out! I want to hear nothing but ripping of Mr. Pritchard! We'll separate it, put it on a roll! Not the Bible, you're not going to go to hell for this. Make a clean tear, I'll have nothing left of it. Rip it out, rip!
Have you all seen Dead Poets Society before?
Oh, yeah.
Reason I share that is I kind of feel like I'm about, whenever I give this presentation, which has been twice before now, I feel like I'm about to give you the horizontal vertical graph version of how to understand an allegory. Which just completely rob it of its beauty and its meaning and its the reality of it. You can't really analyze allegories like on a graph. To say what we were saying earlier, it's not really a hard science. It's a soft science. Language is fluid and carries meaning in very different ways than numbers do. That's part of the point. That said, we're going to engage in some of the dry technical triad analysis of allegory. So, try and give it some definitions, and here are a few. To say something other than normally intended by the word spoken. A figure of speech, often an intended metaphor, frequently employed in scripture. That's from a Bible dictionary. A representation of an abstract or spiritual meaning through concrete or material forms. Figurative treatment of one subject under the guise of another, or a symbolic narrative. Mm. Doesn't that just ring true to your soul?
So basically just symbolism.
Yeah. My definition, a complex metaphor, or string of metaphors, in story form, the story part is kind of key for an allegory, where the characters, events, and settings represent literal realities used to make a point. By that definition, something that might pop in your head of an allegory, which we mentioned earlier, is a parable. Almost all parables are allegories. They're a complex story form metaphor that's used to illustrate a point. Right? That said, we have to figure out what is a metaphor. Y'all know what a metaphor is? Think back to your English class.
It's a simile without the like or as.
And what's a simile?
It uses like or as.
It's a metaphor that uses like or as. Yeah, it's oftentimes it's easier to just give examples and you'll understand from that. So, an example of a metaphor. Did you see that man jump? He's got kangaroo legs. All right, that's a metaphor. He does not actually have kangaroo legs. What is the intended meaning of saying that he has kangaroo legs?
He jumps so high. It's really good.
He jumps really well. It's as though his legs were that of a kangaroo. Now, there is a literal interpretation of this metaphor. The literal interpretation is a guy is jumping around. Oh, and by the way, he's carrying around two disembodied legs of a kangaroo. They are two separate statements, right? Did you see that guy jump? He's got kangaroo legs! Why does he have kangaroo legs, right? That's the less likely interpretation. You with me?
What's so special about those kangaroo legs?
Yeah. They help me jump high, okay?
But it's using a non-literal meaning to convey an idea. In this case, the idea is he jumps well. Which gives it emphasis.
For he jumps good.
If this were viewed in isolation, if it were just he's got kangaroo legs, all right, the meaning is less clear, right? If you don't have the sentence, did you see that man jump, beforehand, it's less clear what you're saying by the idea that he has kangaroo legs. But you still might get there, right? The metaphor could stand on its own, but not as strongly as when viewed in its larger context. Usually, the broader context is what tells you when a metaphor is happening. It's just kind of a natural way that we speak. We use metaphors all the time. Another example that's less concrete. She drowned in an ocean of grief. Okay, this I put this one in here to point out that metaphors can use non-physical realities as their as the thing that they're representing. So it's still. It's using, what was our definition? Using a literal, I wish I had my notes because it was all worded so perfectly in there. using a some reality to describe another reality is essentially what it is. And it can be a non-physical reality, but still a reality. It's still a definite idea that you are communicating, right? That's what I'm trying to get at with the non-physical thing. But she drowned in an ocean of grief. Grief.
Did she die?
Grief doesn't come in oceans, does it? The point is, you're indicating the hugeness of it.
Unless grief is a fish.
Yeah. Unless grief is a fish.
Or a food.
So in an ocean.
But why would the fish drown?
But do we know of any oceans in full of grief in our known universe?
The Dead Sea.
Yeah. No, that's full of salt water.
Good one.
But everybody knows what a metaphor is, right?
Yes.
We're clear looking at some of the realities. There are some examples that were unique to the class that I was doing. Dr. Klingler's mind is a steel trap, but one that has been left out in the rain and has rusted shut. That's funny if you know Dr. Klingler, but not as funny.
So funny, Stephen.
Yeah. Here's some basic truths about metaphors and allegories. First of all metaphors are employed to describe some literal reality. So we just talked about that. May not be a physical reality, but it is a literal one. There is a literal thing going on. So in the ocean of grief thing, there's still a reality. She is sad. That is a literal reality that is occurring, that's being described with a metaphor.
That is large. Large like an ocean.
And it's large like an ocean. There is a whole lot of it. But that is a key thing to realize. Metaphors always describe some literal reality. You don't have a metaphor that has no referent. Does that make sense? It's describing something literal in a figurative way. It's never just a figure that has no literal referent. It's not pointing to something, some actual meaning. Otherwise, it's just nonsense. metaphors are not nonsense. They're conveying some specific meaning. It's just not the one that would naturally be assumed by those words. With me? All metaphors make their description without words like, or as. That would be a simile. Multiple metaphors in story form make an allegory, but each individual metaphor still refers to some reality. Again, that's important. All metaphors refer to some literal reality. This is where the allegorical interpretation starts to fall flat, because you start forgetting what the literal reality is behind the metaphor. We'll get to that. Metaphors require context to determine meaning. So, as we saw with the kangaroo legs, you know that a metaphor is going on mostly just because you know the language, you know how it works. You hear the ideas that are being communicated, and they just kind of happen. Does that make sense? Like, it's just how language works. We talk in metaphors all the time, and we just know them because of the context. Because we're thinking human beings that use metaphors and allegories. That said, there are still some clues. So when you're reading a metaphor or an allegory, how do you tell? So, what time is it? Yeah, 15 minutes.
It's
yeah, turn 16, to Ezekiel 16.
47.
We'll see this in action. How do we apply the proper grammatical literal interpretation that encounters an allegory?
Did you actually bring your Bible this time? Yes, Leah. I brought my Bible.
Ezekiel 16 essentially is a little story. It's an allegory. The chapter is, I think, a standalone allegory giving a prophecy about Israel, as most of the prophets are giving prophecies about Israel, that is. We're not going to read all of it, but... So it starts with the words, again, the word of the Lord came to me. So that lets you know, okay, new prophecy, beginning of a section. This is where the context begins for the allegory. So the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man. That's a name for Ezekiel, by the way. You thought that was just one of Jesus' names. Yeah, Ezekiel had it in here, too. Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations. So what is he going to make known?
Her abominations.
To who?
To
Jerusalem. So that's who he's talking to. We still haven't encountered an allegory yet. At least not, it doesn't seem so. And say, thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem. Your origin and your birth are of the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. And as for your birth on the days you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to cleanse you, nor rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in swaddling cloths. No, I pitied you to do any of the things to you out of compassion for you. But you were cast out in an open field. You were abhorred on the day that you were born. Who's he talking to?
Jerusalem.
Okay. But he's talking like it's a baby.
So metaphor or a person.
Metaphor, there you go. So how do we know this is a metaphor? Well, I mean, you want to get technical, let's draw our graph. This is how you do the whole technical drawing, the graph kind of, how do we prove this is a metaphor? Well, he's using literal things that would be related only to a literal baby if there were not some other context telling us so. But since he says we're talking to Jerusalem, which is a nation of people and or a city, not a single human person who had a birth with an umbilical cord and blood and breasts and hair who could be naked, these words clue us in that an extended metaphor is taking place. So the person Jerusalem is representing some... The person is the metaphor for the literal reality of Jerusalem as a people. Whatever the person Jerusalem does in this allegory is supposed to be representative of the people, the city, Jerusalem, and we'll draw our meaning as we keep going. Clear allegory components appear all through, even until verse 61, the word sister, right? Cities don't really have sisters. Humans have sisters. So that's how you know Ezekiel 16 is an allegory. As for interpreting the allegory of 16, you guys want to keep going and figure out what Ezekiel 16 teaches? Or are you good? You understand what an allegory is somewhere?
I got it. Onward.
Onward? Who says onward?
I say I got it, and onward if you want.
Okay.
I got nothing to do with my time.
Okay. How much time I got?
Like 10, 12 minutes.
Yeah, we can look at these minutes. This is actually a really cool allegory once you get to the end of it. Essentially, I'll summarize it for you. If we're doing this right, I'd give you all of the broader context so you can faithfully exegete the allegory. Here's the outline, though. First of all, Jerusalem's birth. That's what we just read, verses 1 through 5. Then he talks about when I, Yahweh, passed by you, this baby who was just born. So verse 6, when I passed by you and saw you wallowing in your blood, I said to you in your blood, live. I said to you in your blood, live. I made you flourish like a plant of the field, and you grew up and became tall and arrived at full adornment. Your breasts were formed and your hair had grown, yet you were naked and bare. So what did God do for Jerusalem when he found them?
Helped
him. Yeah, he saved them. He brought them to life. He made them flourish. Kept them from dying, because when you leave a baby out and lying in its own blood without somebody coming along to help, they're going to die.
Really?
He chose them. He chose Jerusalem. Then the second pass. I passed by you again and saw you, and behold, you were at the age for love. And I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord, and you became mine. Does this remind you of anything that happened in Israel's history? Maybe when he made a covenant with them? when he chose them as his people? Your descendants will be as like the sands of the shores of the sea? That kind of thing? Yeah. He's describing, and in the allegory what it is this woman that he married. That the I in the allegory marries this woman. What does this woman go on and do? Unfortunately, we learn. So jump down to verse 15. But you trusted in your beauty and played the whore because of your renown and lavished your whorings on any passersby. Your beauty became his. It's in the passersby. You took some of your garments and made for yourselves colorful shrines, and on them you played the whore, the like of which has never has been, nor ever shall be. You also took your beautiful jewels and my gold and of my silver, which I had given to you. You took all the good things I gave you, and you messed them up. And made for yourself images of men, and with them played the whore. So, in the allegory, this woman who marries this man begins doing what?
Cheating.
Cheating. Sleeping around. Prostituting herself. So the literal reality behind that, spoilers, is when Israel is being idolatrous, right? Taking the gold and silver that he had given him and making images of man, worshipping other false gods instead of the true God.
Right? Wait, what verse are you on?
I just finished verse 17. He goes on and describes the depths to which the woman whores around and the terrible things that she does. They're all metaphors describing literal realities that Israel had done. So verse 35, he starts dishing out his judgment. Because you've done this. So verse 35, therefore, O prostitute, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God. Because your lust was poured out and your nakedness uncovered in your whorings with your lovers and with all your abominable idols, and because of the blood of your children that you gave to them, therefore, behold, I will gather all of your lovers with you, with whom you took pleasure, all that you loved and all those that you hated, I will gather them against you from every side and uncover your nakedness to them. So, yeah, you uncovered your nakedness to them. Now I'm going to uncover your nakedness to them. What does that mean he's going to do? He's going to kill them. And more literally, verse 38, I will judge you as a woman who commits adultery shall shed blood and a woman who commit adultery and shed blood are judged and bring upon you the blood and the wrath of jealousy. I will give you into their hands. They shall throw down your vaulted chamber, break down your lofty place. They shall strip you of your clothes, take your beautiful jewels, leave you naked and bare. They shall bring a crowd up against you, and they shall stone you and cut you to pieces with their swords. They shall burn your houses, execute judgment upon you in the sight of many women. I will make you stop playing the whore, and you shall also give payment no more. So will I satisfy my wrath on you, and my jealousy shall depart from you. I'm going to kill you, is what he's saying. He's a jealous husband. You went around whoring, and he says, I'm going to kill you as a result. That's what he's going to do to Jerusalem. So he goes on in vivid detail, describing the kind of judgment that's going to befall Jerusalem. He starts talking about their family, the Jerusalem's two sisters, and they name the sisters. Again, this is how allegorical interpretation works. He's building a massive metaphor, and you have to determine what are the little realities behind the allegory. Here's the beautiful part, though. I'll just wing it here. If you leave it there, it's just an awful story, and God is just a terrible person. But verse 53. I will restore their fortunes, both the fortunes of Sodom and her daughters, and the fortunes of Samaria and her daughters. I will restore your own fortunes in their midst, that you may bear your disgrace, be ashamed of all that you have done, becoming a consolation to them. As for your sister Sodom and her daughters shall return to their former state, Samaria and her daughters shall return to their former state, and you and your daughters shall return to your former state. Skip down to verse 58. You bear the penalty of your lewdness and your abominations, declares the Lord. Verse 59. For thus says the Lord your God, I will deal with you as you have done, you who have despised the oath in breaking the covenant, yet I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth. Remember? I will stay faithful even though you didn't. And I will establish for you an everlasting covenant. So I'm going to make a new covenant with you. Not only the one that I already made to you, an everlasting one. Then you will remember your ways and be ashamed when you took your sisters, both your elder and your younger, and I give them to you as daughters, but not on account of the covenant with you. I will establish my covenant with you. You shall know that I am the Lord, that you may remember and be confounded, and never open your mouth again because of your shame, when I atone for you for all that you have done, declares the Lord. So, his promise to the whore at the end is, I will restore you, I will make an everlasting covenant with you, and I will atone for all you have done. All of the sins you've committed, I will atone for. What's he talking about? Jesus. What do you know? He's in the Old Testament. almost like when he said over and over and over again, Moses and the prophets testify of me. Almost like he knew what he was talking about. He's talking about the new covenant, the church. It's a great passage. You spend a little bit of time digging into that allegory. And in particular, it's interesting. So he literally says he'll kill them. And then he says they'll return to their former state. What do you think that's talking about? Resurrection. Yeah, resurrection. Right here in the Old Testament. Like when Paul boils down the gospel in 1 Corinthians 15 to resurrection. Almost like he got it from somewhere. Yeah. So That's how to do good allegorical interpretation. So when there's an allegory, interpret it. When there's not an allegory, don't treat it like that. Did I hit my mark?
No.
4 minutes.